down the length of my arm to where my hand rests on the bed near his knee. I didn't get a house or buy my own dishwasher or anything. I doubt I'll ever be able to. His eyebrow arches and his eyes retrain on my face. "You don't want to," he says quietly. "Yeah, you're probably right," I say. "But honestly, I'm unsure. That's the problem. I haven't wanted the things I used to want, the things I wanted when I made just about every big life decision I've made. I'm still paying off student loans for a degree I didn't finish, and even if I saved myself another year and a half's worth of tuition, lately I find myself wondering if that was the right choice. I fled Linfield, I fled the University of Chicago, and if I'm being honest, I sort of fled Alex when everything happened. He fled me too, but I can't place all the blame on him. I was terrified. I ran, and I left it up to him to fix it. Remember when we went to San Francisco and we kept saying when in Rome whenever we wanted to buy something?" I ask.
"Maybe," he says, sounding uncertain.
I'm guessing my expression must be something along the lines of crushed because he apologetically adds,
"I don't have a great memory."
"Yeah," I say. "That makes sense." He coughs.
"Do you want to watch something, or are you going back out?"
"No," I say. "Let's watch something. If I go back to the Palm Springs Art Museum, I think the FBI will be waiting for me."
"Why, did you steal something priceless?"
Alex asks. "I won't know until I have it appraised," I joke. "Hopefully this Claude Monet guy turns out to be a big deal." Alex laughs and shakes his head, and even that small gesture seems to cost him a shock of pain.
"Shit," he says. "You have to stop making me laugh."
"You have to stop assuming I'm joking when I'm talking about robbing art museums." He closes his eyes and presses his mouth into a straight line, smothering any more laughter. After a second, he opens his eyes.
"Okay, I'm going to go pee for, hopefully, the last time today and take another pill. You can grab my laptop from the bag and pull up Netflix if you want."
He cautiously turns, sets his feet on the ground, and stands. "Got it," I say. "And do you want me to leave the nudie mags in there or get those out too?"
"Poppy," he groans without looking back. "No joking."
I push off the bed and tug Alex's laptop bag onto the chair as I sort through it for the computer, then carry it back to the bed with me, opening it as I go. He hasn't shut it down, and when I brush the mouse pad, the screen flares to life, demanding that I log in. "Password?" I call toward the bathroom.
"Flannery O'Connor," he calls back,
then flushes the toilet and turns on the sink. I don't ask about spaces, capitalization, or punctuation. Alex is a purist. I type it in, and the login screen vanishes, replaced by an open web browser. Before I've realized it, I'm inadvertently snooping. My heart is racing. The water turns off, the door opens, Alex steps out, and while it might be better to pretend I didn't see the job posting Alex had pulled up, something's come over me, yanked out the part of my brain that, at least occasionally, filters out things I shouldn't say. "You're applying to teach at Berkeley Carroll?" The confusion on his face quickly transforms into something akin to guilt.
"Oh, that."
"That's in New York," I say.
"So the website suggested," Alex says.
"New York City," I clarify.
"Wait, that New York?"
He deadpans. "You're moving to New York?" I say, and I'm sure I'm talking loud, but the adrenaline has me feeling like the whole world is stuffed with cotton, deadening all sound to a muffled hum.
"Probably not," he said. "I just saw the posting."
"But you would love New York," I say. "I mean, think about the bookstores." Now he gives me a smile that seems both amused and sad. He comes back to the bed and slowly lowers himself down next to me.
"I don't know," he says. "I was just looking."
"I won't bother you," I say. "If you're worried I'll like show up on your doorstep every time I have a crisis, I promise I won't." His eyebrow lifts skeptically.
"And if you find out I have a back spasm, will you break into my apartment with donuts and Icy Hot?"
"No," I say, pitch lifting guiltily. His smile widens, but still there's something vaguely sad about it.
What is it?
He holds my eyes for a while, like we're caught in a game of chicken. Then he sighs and runs a hand over his face.
I don't know, he says. There's some stuff I'm still trying to work out, in Linfield, before I make a decision like that.
The house, I guess.
That's part of it, he says. I love that house. I don't know if I could bear to sell it.
You could rent it out, I suggest, and Alex gives me a look. Right. You're way too high-strung to be a landlord.
I believe you mean that everyone else is way too lax to be a tenant.
You could rent it to one of your brothers, I say. Or you can just keep it. I mean, your grandma owned it, right? Do you owe anything on it?
Just property taxes.
He pulls the computer away from me and exits out of the job posting.
But it's not just the house. And it's not just because of my dad and brothers either,
he adds when he sees my mouth opening.
I mean, obviously I'd miss my nieces and nephew a lot, but there are other things keeping me there. Or, I don't know, there might be. I'm just kind of waiting to see what happens.
Oh, I say, realization dawning. So like, a woman? Again, he holds my gaze, as if daring me to push the matter. But I don't blink, and he cracks first.
We don't have to talk about this.
Oh. And now all that vibrating, excited energy seems to be freezing over, sinking low in my stomach. So it's Sarah. You are getting back together. He bows his head, rubs at his brow.
I don't know.
She wants to? I say. Or you do?
I don't know, he says again.
Alex!
Don't do that.
He looks up.
Don't chastise me. It's really grim out there, dating-wise, and Sarah and I have a lot of history.
Yeah, a sordid history, I say. There's a reason you broke up. Twice.
And a reason we dated, he fires back. Not everyone can just not look back like you.
What's that supposed to mean? I demand.
Nothing, he says quickly. We're just different.
I know we're different, I say, defensive. I also know it's grim out there. I'm single too, Alex. I'm a card-carrying member of the unsolicited dick pic support group. Doesn't mean I'm running to get back with one of my exes.
It's different, he insists.
How? I snap.
Because you don't want the same things I want,
he says, half shouting, possibly the loudest I've ever heard him speak. And while his voice isn't angry, it's definitely frustrated. When I rear back from him, I see him deflate a little, embarrassed. He goes on, quiet and controlled once more.
I want all that stuff my brothers have, he says. I want to get married and have kids and grandkids and get really fucking old with my wife and to live in our house for so long that it smells like us. Like, I want to pick out fucking furniture and paint colors and do all that Linfield stuff you think is so unbearable, okay? That's what I want. And I don't want to wait. No one knows how long they get, and I don't want 10 more years to go by and to find out I have fucking dick cancer or something and it's too late for me. That stuff is what matters to me.
Any remaining fire goes out of him, but I'm still quivering with nerves and hurt and shame, and most of all, anger with myself for not understanding what was going on every time he defended our podunk hometown, or changed the topic from Sarah, or anything else. Alex, I say, on the verge of tears. I shake my head, trying to clear the storm clouds of gathering emotion. I don't think that stuff is unbearable. I don't think any of it's unbearable. His eyes lift heavily to mine, dart away again. Careful not to knock him, I shift closer and pull his hand into mine, fold my fingers through his. Alex? He looks down at me.
Sorry, he murmurs. I'm sorry, Poppy.
I shake my head. I love Betty's house, I say. And I love thinking about you having it. And as much as I hated school, I love thinking about you teaching there and how lucky those kids are. And I love what a good brother and son you are. And
My words catch in my throat, and I have to stammer tearily through the rest of them.
And I don't want you to marry Sarah because she takes you for granted. She would never have broken up with you in the first place if she didn't. And honestly, aside from that, I don't want you to marry her because she never liked me. And if you marry her...
I trail off before I can start sobbing. If you marry her, I think, I will lose all of you forever. And then, probably no matter who you marry, I will have to lose you forever.
I know that's so selfish, I say. But it's not just that. I really think you can do better. Sarah will be great for someone, but not for you. She doesn't like karaoke, Alex.
This last part comes out pathetically teary, and as he gazes down at me, he tries his best to hide the smile that pulls at his mouth. He frees his hand from mine and wraps his arm around me, pressing me lightly to him, but I don't let myself sink into him like I want for fear of hurting him. This injury, while miserable for him, is actually turning out to be a good buffer, because everywhere we're touching has started to buzz, like my nerves are jockeying for more of him. He presses a kiss to the top of my head, and it feels like someone cracked an egg there, something warm and sultry dripping down over me. I shove down the hazy memories of everything that mouth did in Croatia.
I'm not sure I actually can do better, Alex says, drawing me out of a blush-worthy scene. When I open Tinder, it just shows me a middle finger.
Seriously? I sit up. You have a Tinder account? He rolls his eyes.
Yes, Poppy, Grandpa has a Tinder.
Let me see it. His ears go red.
No thanks, I'm not in the mood to get brutally heckled.
I can help you, Alex, I say. I'm a straight woman. I know how men's Tinder profiles are received. I can figure out what you're doing wrong.
What I'm doing wrong is trying to find a meaningful connection on a dating app.
Well, obviously, I say, but let's see what else. He sighs.
Fine.
He pulls his phone out of his pocket and hands it to me.
But go easy on me, Poppy. I'm fragile right now.
And then he makes the face. 17. 7 summers ago. New Orleans. Alex is curious about the architecture. All those old Crayola-colored buildings with their wrought iron balconies and the ancient trees writhing up right through the sidewalks, roots sprawling out for yards in every direction, breaking up cement like it's nothing. The trees predate it, and they'll outlast it. I'm excited for alcohol in slushy form and kitschy supernatural shops. Luckily, there is no shortage of any of it. I'm thrilled to find a large studio apartment not far from Bourbon Street. The floors are stained dark, and the furniture is heavy wood, and colorful paintings of jazz musicians hang on exposed brick walls. The beds are cheap-looking, as is the bedding, but they're queens, and the place is clean, and the air-conditioning game is so strong we have to crank it down so that every time we come in after a day in the heat, our teeth don't chatter. All there really is to do in New Orleans, it seems, is walk, eat, drink, look, and listen. This is basically what we do on every trip, but the fact is underscored here by the hundreds of restaurants and bars sitting shoulder to shoulder on every slender street, and the thousands of people milling through the city with tall neon novelty cups and mismatched straws. Every block or so, the smells of the city switch from fried and delicious to stinking and rotten, the humidity trapping the sewage and putting it on display. Compared to most American cities, everything looks so old that I imagine we're smelling waste from the 1700s, which miraculously makes it more bearable.
It feels like we're walking around inside someone's mouth, Alex says more than once about the humidity, and from then on, whenever the smell hits, I think of food trapped between molars.
But the thing is, it never lasts. A breeze sweeps through to clear it out, or we wander past another restaurant with all its doors propped open, or we round the corner and stumble onto some beautiful side street where every balcony overhead is dripping with purple flowers. Besides,
I've been in New York for 5 months now, and during the last 2 months of summer, it's not like my subway stop has smelled like roses. I've seen 3 different people peeing on the steps inside and watched one of those people do it a second time a week later. I love New York, but wandering New Orleans, I wonder if I could be just as happy here. If maybe I could be happier. If maybe Alex would visit me more often. So far, he's visited New York once, a few weeks after his first year of grad school ended. He brought a carload of my stuff from my parents' house to my apartment in Brooklyn, and on the last day of his trip, we compared calendars, talked about when we'd next see each other. The summer trip, obviously. Possibly, but probably not, Thanksgiving. Christmas, if I could get time off work at the restaurant where I'm serving. But everyone wants off for Christmas, so instead I floated the idea of New Year's Eve, and we agreed to figure it out later. So far, we haven't talked about any of that on this trip. I haven't wanted to think about missing Alex while I'm with him. It seems like a waste.
If nothing else, he joked, we'll always have the summer trip.
I had to actively decide to see that as comforting. From morning until hours after dark, we wander. Bourbon Street and Frenchman and Canal and Esplanade. Alex is particularly enamored of the stately old houses on this street, with their overflowing flower beds and sun-blanched palms rising up alongside craggy oaks. We eat fluffy, sugar-dusted beignets in an open-air cafe and spend hours picking our way through the knick-knacks being sold outside the French market, alligator head keychains and silver rings set with moonstones, the freshly baked breads and chilled local produce and dense little cakes topped with kiwi and strawberries and bourbon-soaked cherries and pralines, in every imaginable manner, being sold in the booths inside. We drink Sazeracs and Hurricanes and daiquiris everywhere we go because staying on theme matters, as Alex says dramatically when I try to order a gin and tonic, and from there, we have both our mantra and our alter egos for the week. Gladys and Keith Vivant are a Broadway power couple, we decide. True performers to their very cores, and as their matching tattoos read, all the world's a stage. They start every day with some acting exercises, stick to one prompt for a whole week at a time, letting it guide their every interaction so as to better inhabit the character. And theme, of course, is vital. Or, you could say, it matters. Theme matters! We scream back and forth, stomping our feet whenever we want each other to do something the other isn't thrilled about. There are a whole lot of vintage stores that seem to have never been cleaned before, and Alex is not thrilled about trying on the suede leather pants I pick out for him in one of these, just as I am not thrilled when he wants to spend 6 hours in an art museum. Theme matters, I shout when he refuses to enter a bar with an, no joke, all saxophone band playing in the middle of the day. Theme matters, he cries, when I say I don't want to buy shirts that say Drunk Bitch 1 and Drunk Bitch 2, like those Thing 1 and Thing 2 shirts they sell at theme parks, and we leave the shop wearing the shirts over our clothes. I love when you get weird, I tell him. He squints tipsily at me as we walk.
You make me weird. I'm not like this with anyone else.
You make me weird, too, I say. Then, should we get real tattoos that say all the world's a stage?
Gladys and Keith would,
Alex says, taking a long drink from his water bottle. He passes it to me afterward, and I greedily chug half of it. So that's a yes?
Please don't make me, he says.
But Alex, I cry, theme matter. He pops the water bottle back into my mouth.
Once you're sober, I promise you won't think it's funny anymore.
I will always think every joke I make is hilarious, I say. But point taken. We hit happy hour after happy hour, with varying results. Sometimes the drinks are weak and bad, sometimes they're stiff and good, often they're stiff and bad. We go to a hotel bar that's mounted to a carousel and each buy one $15 cocktail. We go to, allegedly, the second oldest continuously operating bar in Louisiana. It's an old blacksmith shop with sticky floors that looks like a half-assed living museum, except for the gigantic trivia machine set up in the corner. Alex and I sip slowly on the one shared drink while we wait our turn. We don't break the record, but we make the scoreboard. The fifth night, we wind up at a fratty karaoke bar with an over-the-top stage and laser lights show. After two shots of Fireball, Alex agrees to sing Sonny and Cher's I Got You, Babe on stage, in character as the Vivants. Halfway through the song, we get into a mic'd fight about the fact that I know he's sleeping with Shelley from makeup. It doesn't take an hour to put on a freaking fake beard, Keith, I shout. The applause at the end is muted and uncomfortable. We take another shot and head to a place Guillermo told me about that serves a frozen coffee cocktail. Half the places we've gone have been places Guillermo recommended, and I've loved all of them, especially the hole-in-the-wall po' boy shop. Having a chef for a boyfriend has perks. When I told him where Alex and I were going, he got out a piece of paper and started writing down everything he could remember from his last trip, along with notes about pricing and what to order. He starred all his must-eats, but there's no way we'll get to all of them. I met Guillermo a couple months after moving to New York. My new, first New York, friend Rachel got a request to eat at his new restaurant for free in exchange for posting a few pictures of it on her social media. She does that kind of thing a lot, and since I'm a fellow internet person, we do these sorts of things together. Less embarrassing, she insists. Plus, cross-promotion. Every time she posts a picture with me, my subscriber count goes up by hundreds. I'd been hanging around 36,000 for 6 months, but have ballooned to 55,000 through sheer association with her brand. So I went with her to this restaurant, and after the meal, the chef came out to talk to us, and he was gorgeous and sweet, with soft brown eyes, dark hair swept back off his forehead. His laugh was soft and unassuming, and by that night, he'd messaged me on Instagram before I could even post the pictures I'd taken to my account. He found me through Rachel, and I liked the way he told me that right up front, without embarrassment. He works most nights, so on our first date, we went for breakfast instead, and he kissed me when he picked me up, rather than waiting until he dropped me off afterward. At first, I was seeing a few other people, and he was too, but several weeks into it, we decided neither of us wanted to see anyone else. He laughed when he told me, and I laughed too, just because I'd gotten in the habit of giving encouraging laughter from being around him. It's not like it was with Julian, not all-consuming and unpredictable. We see each other two or three times a week, and it's nice, the way this leaves space in my life for other things. Spin classes with Rachel, and long walks down the mall of Central Park with a dripping ice cream cone in hand, gallery openings, and special movie nights at neighborhood bars. People in New York are friendlier than the rest of the world warned me they would be. When I tell Rachel this, she says, "Most people here aren't assholes. They're just busy." But when I say the same thing to Guillermo, he gently cups my jaw, laughs, and says, "You are so sweet. I hope you don't let this place change you." It's sweet, but it also worries me. Like, maybe the thing Guy loves best about me isn't some essential part, but something changeable, something that could be stripped away by a few years in the right climate. As we wander the streets of New Orleans, I think multiple times of telling Alex about what Guillermo said, but every time I catch myself. I want Alex to like Guillermo, and I worry he'd be offended on my behalf. So I tell him other things, like how calm Guillermo is, that he laughs easily, how passionate he is about his job and food in general. "You'll like him," I say, and I really believe it.
"I'm sure I will," Alex insists. "If you like him, I'll like him."
"Good," I say. And then he tells me about Sarah, his unrequited college crush. He ran into her when he was up in Chicago visiting friends a few weeks ago. They grabbed a drink. "And?"
"And nothing," he says. "She lives in Chicago."
"It's not Mars," I say. "It's not even that far from Indiana University."
"She's been texting me a little," he admits.
"Of course she is," I say. "You're a catch." His smile is bashful and adorable. "I don't know," he says. "Maybe next time I'm in town, we'll meet up again."
"You should," I press.
I'm happy with Guillermo, and Alex deserves to be happy too. Any tension that 5% of our relationship, the what if, let in, seems to have been resolved. While staying in the French Quarter had seemed ideal when I booked our Airbnb, it turns out the nights are pretty loud. The music goes on until 3 or 4 and starts up surprisingly early in the morning. We find ourselves venturing to the rooftop pool at the Ace Hotel, which is free on weekdays, and napping on a couple of chaise longues in the sun. It's probably the best sleep I get all week, so by the time we take the cemetery tour on the last day of the trip, I'm slap happy from fatigue. Alex and I expected haunting ghost stories. Instead, we get information about how the Catholic Church cares for some graves, the ones for which people bought perpetual care generations ago, and lets the others crumble to dust. It is decidedly boring, and we're baking in the sun, and my back hurts from walking in sandals all week, and I'm exhausted from barely sleeping, and halfway through, when Alex realizes how miserable I am, he starts raising his hand every time we stop at another grave for more bland factoids and asking, "So is this grave haunted?" At first, our tour guide laughs his question off, but he's less amused every time it happens. Finally, Alex asks about a big white marble pyramid at odds with the rest of the stacked rectangular French and Spanish style graves, and the tour guide huffs, "I certainly hope not. That one belongs to Nicolas Cage." Alex and I deteriorate into cackles. It turns out he's not joking. This was supposed to be a big reveal, probably with a built-in joke, and we ruined it. "Sorry," Alex says, and passes him a tip as we're leaving. I'm the one who works in a bar, but he's the one who always has cash. "Are you secretly a stripper?" I ask him. "Is that why you always have cash?"
"Exotic dancer," he says.
"You're an exotic dancer?" I say.
"No," he says. "It's just helpful to carry cash."
The sun is going down, and we're both bone tired, but it's our last night, so we decide to get cleaned up and rally. While I'm sitting on the floor in front of the full-length mirror putting on makeup, I peruse Guillermo's list and shout out suggestions to Alex.
"Eh,"
he says after each one. After a handful, he comes to stand behind me, making eye contact in the mirror.
"Can we just wander?"
"I'd love to," I admit. We hit a couple dingy pubs before we wind up at the Dungeon, a small, dark goth bar at the end of a skinny alleyway. We're told that pictures are expressly forbidden before the bouncer lets us into the red-lit front room. It's so packed that I have to hold on to Alex's elbow as we make our way upstairs. There are plastic skeletons hanging on the wall, and a red satin-lined coffin stands waiting for a photo op that you're not allowed to take. Despite our mantra for this trip, and all the free personal shopping I've done for him, Alex has continued to largely loathe themed parties, events, and apparently bars, too.
"This place is horrible," he says. "You love it, don't you?"
I nod, and he grins. We have to stand so close I have to tip my head all the way back to see him at all. He brushes my hair from my eyes and cups the back of my neck, as if to stabilize it.
"I'm sorry for being so tall," he says over the metal music thrumming through the bar.
"I'm sorry for being so short," I say.
"I like you short," he says. "Never apologize for being short."
I lean into him, a hug minus the arms.
"Hey," I say.
"Hey, what?"
he asks.
"Can we go to that country western bar we passed?"
I'm sure he doesn't want to. I'm sure he finds the whole thing humiliating. But what he says is,
"We have to. Theme matters, Poppy."
So we go there next, and it's the polar opposite of the Dungeon, a big open bar with saddles for seats and Kenny Chesney blaring out to no one but us. Alex is chagrined at the thought of sitting on the saddles, but I hop up and try to make his sad puppy face at him.
"What is that?" he says. "Are you okay?"
"I'm being pathetic," I say.
so that you will please make me the happiest woman in the state of Louisiana and sit on one of these saddle seats.
I can't decide if you're too easy to please or too hard, he says, and swings one leg over, pulling himself onto the saddle next to mine. Excuse me, he says to a burly bartender in a black leather vest. Give me something that will make me forget this ever happened.
Still polishing a glass, he turns and glares.
I'm no mind reader, kid. What do you want?
Alex's cheeks flush. He clears his throat.
Beer's fine. Whatever you've got.
Make that two, I say. Two of those alcohols, please.
As the bartender turns to get our drinks, I lean over to Alex and almost fall off my saddle in the process. He catches me and holds me up as I whisper, he's so on theme. It's only 11:30 when we leave, but I'm wiped out and as unthirsty as I've ever been in my life. So we just walk down the middle of the street with all the other revelers, families in matching reunion t-shirts, white-clad brides with silky pink bachelorette sashes and towering heels, drunk middle-aged men hitting on the girls in pink bachelorette sashes, stuffing dollar bills in their dress straps as they walk past. Overhead, people line the upstairs balconies of bars and restaurants, waving purple, gold, and green beads around, and when a man wolf whistles and shakes a handful of necklaces at me, I hold my arms up to catch them. He shakes his head and pantomimes lifting his shirt up. I hate him, I say to Alex.
Me too, Alex agrees.
But I have to admit, he is on theme.
Alex laughs and we walk onward with no destination in mind. Gradually, the foot traffic slows as we approach a brass band, saxophone and other woodwind free, that set up shop in the middle of the street, horns blasting, drums rattling. We stop to watch, and a few couples start dancing. In the twist of the century, Alex offers me his hand, and when I take it, he twirls me in a lazy circle and pulls me in close, one hand around my back, the other folded against mine. He rocks me back and forth, and we both giggle sleepily. We're not on the beat, but it doesn't matter. It's just us. Maybe that's why he can handle the public affection. Maybe, like me, when we're together, he feels like no one else is there, like they're phantoms we dreamed up as set dressing. Even if Jason Stanley and every other bully from my past were here mocking me through a megaphone, I don't think I'd stop dancing clumsily with Alex in the street. He spins me out and back in, tries to dip me, almost drops me. I yelp when it happens, laugh so hard I snort when he catches me and swings me upright onto my feet, rocking me some more. When the song ends, we break apart and join the crowd in applause. Alex crouches for a second, and when he stands up, he's holding out a strand of chipped purple Mardi Gras beads.
Those were on the ground, I say.
You don't want them?
No, I want them, I say, but they were on the ground.
Yes, he says.
Where there's dirt, I say, and spilled booze, possibly vomit.
He winces, starts to lower the beads. I catch his wrist, stilling him.
Thank you, I say. Thank you for touching these filthy beads for me, Alex. I love them.
He rolls his eyes, smiles, slips the beads over my neck as I duck my head. When I look back up at him, he's beaming at me, and I think, I love you more now than I ever have. How is it possible that this keeps happening with him?
Can we take a picture together? I ask,
but what I'm thinking is, I wish I could bottle this moment and wear it as a perfume. It would always be with me. Everywhere I went, he'd be there too, and so I'd always feel like myself. He takes his phone out, and we huddle together as he snaps a picture. When we look at it, he makes a sound of strangled surprise. Probably in an effort not to look so sleepy, he threw his eyes wide in the last possible second.
You look like you saw something horrible exactly when the flash went off, I say.
He tries to pull the phone out of my hands, but I spin away from him, jog out of reach as I text it to myself. He follows, fighting a smile, and when I hand it back, I say,
There, now that I have a copy, you can delete it.
I would never delete it, Alex says. I'm just only going to look at it when I'm alone, locked in my apartment, so that no one else ever sees my face in this picture.
I'm going to see it, I say.
You don't count, he says.
I know, I agree.
I love that, being the one who doesn't count, the one who's allowed to see all of Alex, the one who makes him weird.
When we get back to the apartment, I ask when he's going to let me read the short stories he's been working on. He says he can't. If I don't like them, he'll be too embarrassed. You got into an amazing MFA program, I say. You're obviously good. If I don't think they're good, I'm obviously wrong. He says that if I don't think they're good, then you of I is wrong. Please, I say.
Okay, he says, and gets out his computer. Just wait until I'm in the shower, okay? I don't want to have to watch you reading it.
Okay, I say. If you have a novel, I could read that instead, since I'll have the whole length of an Alex Nilsson shower.
He tosses a pillow at me and goes into the bathroom. The story really is short. 9 pages about a boy who was born with a pair of wings. All his life, people tell him that this means he should try to fly. He's afraid to. When he finally does, jumps off a 2-story roof, he falls. He breaks his legs and wings. He never gets them reset. As he recovers, the bone heals in its misshapen form. Finally, people stop telling him that he must have been born to fly. Finally, he's happy. When Alex comes back out, I'm crying. He asks me what's wrong. I say, I don't know. It just speaks to me. He thinks I'm making a joke and chuckles along. But for once, I wasn't referencing the gallery girl who tried to sell us a $21,000 bear sculpture. I was thinking about what Julian used to say about art, how it either makes you feel something or it doesn't. When I read his story, I started crying for a reason I can't totally explain, not even to Alex. When I was a kid, I used to have these panic attacks, thinking about how I could never be anyone else. I couldn't be my mom or my dad, and for my whole life, I'd have to walk around inside a body that kept me from ever truly knowing anyone else. It made me feel lonely, desolate, almost hopeless. When I told my parents about this, I expected them to know the feeling I was talking about, but they didn't.
That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with feeling that way, though, sweetie, Mom insisted.
Who else do you think about being?
My dad said with his particular blunt fascination. The fear lessened, but the feeling never went away. Every once in a while, I'd roll it back out, poke at it, wonder how I could ever stop feeling lonely when no one could ever know me all the way, when I could never peer into someone else's brain and see it all. And now I'm crying because reading this story makes me feel for the first time that I'm not in my body. Like there's some bubble that stretches around me and Alex and makes it so we're just 2 different colored globs in a lava lamp, mixing freely, dancing around each other, unhindered. I'm crying because I'm relieved, because I will never again feel as alone as I did during those long nights as a kid. As long as I have him, I will never be alone again. 18. This summer.
Alex! I shriek at the sight of his Tinder profile. No!
What? What? He says. There's no way you've read everything by now.
First of all, I say, brandishing his phone out in front of us. Don't you think that's a problem? Your bio looks like the cover letter to a resume. I didn't even know Tinder bios could be this long. Isn't there some kind of character limit? No one is going to read this whole thing.
If they're really interested, they will, he says, slipping the phone out of my hand.
Maybe if they're interested in harvesting your organs, they'll skim to the bottom just to make sure you don't mention your blood type. Do you?
No, he says, sounding hurt, then adds, just my weight, height, BMI, and social security number. Is what I wrote good at least?
Oh, we're not talking about that just yet.
I pluck his phone from his hand again, angle the screen toward him, and zoom in on his profile picture.
First, we have to talk about this.
He frowns. I like that picture.
Alex, I say calmly, there are 4 people in this picture,
So?
So we have found the first and largest problem.
That I have friends? I thought that would help.
You poor innocent baby creature, freshly arrived to Earth, I coo.
Women don't want to date men who have friends,
he says dryly, disbelieving. Of course they do, I say. They just don't want to play dating app roulette. How are they supposed to know which one of these guys is you? The guy on the left is like 80.
Biology teacher, he says.
His frown deepens.
I don't really take pictures by myself.
You sent me those sad puppy selfies, I point out.
That's different, he says. That was for you. You think I should use one of those?
God no, I say. But you could take a new picture where you're not making that face. Or you could crop one that's you and three biology teachers of a certain age so that it's just you.
I'm making a weird face in that picture, he says. I'm always making a weird face in pictures.
I laugh, but really, warm affection is growing in my belly. You have a face for movies, not photographs, I say.
Meaning?
Meaning you're extremely handsome in real life when your face is moving how it does, but when 1 millisecond is captured, yes, sometimes you're making a weird face.
So basically, I should delete Tinder and throw my phone into the sea.
Wait! I jump out of bed and snatch my phone off the counter where I left it, then climb back up beside Alex, tucking my legs underneath me. I know what you should use. He dubiously watches me scroll through my photos. I'm looking for a picture from our Tuscany trip, the last trip before Croatia. We'd been sitting outside on the patio, eating a late dinner, and he slipped away without a word. I figured he'd gone to the bathroom, but when I went inside to get dessert, he was in the kitchen, biting his lip and reading an email on his phone. He looked worried, didn't seem to notice I was there until I touched his arm and said his name. When he looked up, his face went slack. What is it? I asked, and the first thing that jumped into my mind was Grandma Betty. She was getting old. Actually, as long as I'd known her, she'd been old, but the last time we'd gone to her house together, she'd barely gotten up from the chair she did her knitting in. Until then, she'd always been a bustler, bustling to the kitchen to get us lemonade, bustling over to the sofa to fluff the cushions before we sat down. But the thought didn't have time to gestate because Alex's tiny, ever-suppressed smile appeared.
Tin House, he said. They're publishing one of my stories.
He gave a surprised laugh after he said it, and I threw my arms around him, let him draw me up and in against him tight. I kissed his cheek without thinking, and if it had felt any less natural to him than it did to me, he didn't show it. He turned me in half a circle, set me down, grinning, went back to staring at his phone. He forgot to hide his emotions. He let them run wild over his face. I tugged my phone out of my pocket, pulled up my camera, and said, Alex. When he looked up, I captured my favorite picture of Alex Nilsson. Unfiltered happiness. Naked Alex. Here, I say, and show him the picture. Him, standing in a warm golden kitchen in Tuscany, his hair sticking up like it always did, his phone loose in his hand, and his eyes locked onto the camera, his mouth smiling but ajar. You should use this one. He turns from the phone to me. Our faces close, though, as ever, his hangs over mine, his mouth soft with a trace of smile.
I forgot about that, he says.
It's my favorite. For a while, neither of us moves. We linger in this moment of close silence. I'll send it to you, I say weakly, and break eye contact, pulling up our text thread and dropping the picture into it. Alex's phone buzzes in his lap where I must have dropped it. He picks it up, does his half-cough tick.
Thanks.
So, I say, about that bio.
Should we print it out and find a red pen? He jokes.
No way, man. This planet is dying. No way I'm wasting that much paper.
Ha ha ha, he says. I was trying to be thorough.
As thorough as Dostoevsky.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
Shh. I say, reading. Already knowing Alex, I do find the bio kind of charming, mostly in that it speaks to that lovable grandpa side of him.
But if I didn't know him and one of my friends read me this bio, I would suggest that perhaps this man was a serial killer. Unfair? Probably. But that doesn't change things. He lists where he went to school, when he graduated, talks in depth about what he studied, the last few jobs he had, his strengths at said jobs, the fact that he hopes to get married and have kids, and that he is close with his three brothers and their spouses and children, and enjoys teaching literature to gifted high school students. I must be making a face because he sighs and says, "It's really that bad?" "No," I say.
"Is that a question?"
he asks. "No," I say. "I mean, no, it's not bad. It's kind of cute, but Alex, what are you supposed to talk about when you go out with a girl who's already read all this?" He shrugs.
"I don't know. Probably I'd just ask them questions about themselves."
"That feels like a job interview," I say. "I mean, yes, it is a rare and wonderful thing when your Tinder date asks you a single question about yourself, but you can't just not talk about yourself at all." He rubs at the line in his forehead.
"God, I really hate having to do this. Why is it so hard to meet people in real life?"
"It might be easier in another city," I say pointedly. He glances askance at me and rolls his eyes, but he's smiling.
"Okay, what would you write if you were a guy trying to woo yourself?"
"Well, I'm different," I say. "What you've got here would totally work on me." He laughs.
"Don't be mean."
"I'm not," I say. "You sound like a sexy child-rearing robot, like the maid from the Jetsons, but with abs."
"Poppy!"
He groan laughs, throwing his forearm over his face. Okay, I'll take a crack at it." I take his phone again and erase what he wrote, committing it to memory as well as I can in case he wants to restore it. I think for a minute, then type, and pass the phone back to him. He studies the screen for a long time, then reads aloud,
"I have a full-time job and an actual bed frame. My house isn't full of Tarantino posters, and I text back within a couple hours. Also, I hate the saxophone."
"Oh, did I put a question mark?" I ask, leaning over his shoulder to see. "That's supposed to be a period."
"It's a period," he says. "I just wasn't sure if you were serious."
"Of course I'm serious."
"I have an actual bed frame," he says again.
"It shows that you're responsible," I say, "and that you're funny."
"It actually shows that you're funny," Alex says.
"But you're funny too," I say. "You're just overthinking this."
"You really think women will want to go out with me based on a picture and the fact that I have a bed frame?"
"Oh, Alex," I say. "I thought you said you knew how grim it was out there."
"All I'm saying is, I walk around all day with this face and a job and a bed frame, and none of that has gotten me very far."
"Yeah, that's because you're intimidating," I say, saving the bio and going back to the slideshow of women's accounts.
"Yeah, that's it,"
Alex says, and I look up at him. "Yes, Alex," I say. "That is it."
"What are you talking about?"
"Remember Clarissa, my roommate at U of Chicago?"
"The trust fund hippie," he says.
"What about Isabel, my sophomore year roommate, or my friend Jacqueline from the communications department?"
"Yes, Poppy, I remember your friends. It wasn't 20 years ago."
"You know what those three people had in common?" I say. "They all had crushes on you. All of them." He blushes.
"You're full of shit."
"No," I say, "I'm not. Clarissa and Isabel were both constantly trying to flirt with you, and Jacqueline's communication skills just utterly failed whenever you were in the room."
"Well, how was I supposed to know that?"
he demands. "Body language, prolonged eye contact," I say. "Finding every excuse to touch you, making overt sexual innuendos, asking you for help with papers."
"We always did that over email,"
Alex says, like he's found a hole in my logic. "Alex," I say calmly, "whose idea was that?" The look of victory leeches from his face.
"Wait, seriously?"
"Seriously," I say. "So, with that in mind, would you like to take your new photo and bio for a spin?" He looks aghast.
I'm not going to go on a date during our trip, Poppy.
Damn right you're not, I say. But you can at least try it out. Besides, I want to see what kinds of girls you swipe right for.
Nuns, he says, and aid workers.
Wow, you're such a good person,
I say in a breathy Marilyn Monroe voice.
Please allow me to show my appreciation with a...
Okay, he says. Don't give yourself an asthma attack. I'll swipe. Just go gently on me, Poppy.
I bump my shoulder lightly against his. Always.
Never, he says.
I frown. Please call me on it if I ever make you feel bad.
You don't, he says. It's fine.
I know I joke rough sometimes, but I never want to hurt you. Not ever. He doesn't smile, just gazes back steadily like he's taking the time to let the words soak in.
I know that.
Okay, good. I nod, train my eyes on his phone screen. Ooh, what about her? The girl on screen is tanned and pretty, bending at the knee and blowing a kiss at the camera.
No kissy faces,
he says, and swipes her off the screen. Fair enough. A girl with a lip ring and dark eye makeup appears in her place. Her bio reads, "All metal, all the time."
That's a lot of metal,
Alex says, and swipes her away too. Next up, a girl in a green leprechaun hat, grinning in a green tank top, holding up a green beer. She has big boobs and a bigger smile. Oh, a nice Irish girl, I joke. Alex vanishes that one without comment. Hey, what's wrong with her? I ask. She was gorgeous.
Not my type, he says.
Okay, moving on. He rejects a rock climber, a Hooters waitress, a painter, and a hip-hop dancer with a body to rival Alex's own. Alex, I say, I'm beginning to think the problem lies not with the bio, but with the biographer.
They're just not my type, he says, and I'm definitely not theirs.
How do you know that?
Look, he says, here, she's cute.
Oh my God, you've got to be kidding me.
What? He says. You don't think she's pretty?
The strawberry blonde smiles up at me from behind a polished mahogany desk. Her hair is clipped back into a half ponytail, and she's wearing a navy blue blazer. According to her bio, she's a graphic designer who loves yoga, sunshine, and cupcakes. Alex, I say, she's Sarah. He rears back.
This girl looks nothing like Sarah.
I snort. I didn't say she looks like Sarah, though she does. I said she is Sarah.
Sarah's a teacher, not a graphic designer, Alex says. She's taller than this girl, and her hair is darker, and her favorite dessert is cheesecake, not cupcakes.
They dress exactly the same. They smile exactly the same. Why do all guys want girls who look like they're carved out of soap?
What are you talking about? Alex says.
I mean, you had no interest in all those cool, sexy girls, and then you see this wannabe kindergarten teacher, and she's the first person you even consider. It's just typical.
She's not a kindergarten teacher, he says. What do you have against this girl?
Nothing, I say. But it doesn't sound like it's true, even to me. I sound annoyed. I open my mouth, hoping to walk my reaction back a little, but that's not what happens at all. It's not the girl, It's guys. You all think you want a sexy, independent hip-hop dancer, but when that person appears in front of you, when she's a real person, she's too much, and you're not interested, and you'll go for the cute kindergarten teacher in the turtleneck every time.
Why do you keep saying she's a kindergarten teacher?
Alex cries. Because she's Sarah, I blurt out.
I don't want to date Sarah, okay? He says. And also, Sarah teaches ninth grade, not kindergarten. And also... He goes on, picking up steam. You talk a big game, Poppy, but I guarantee that when you're on Tinder, you're swiping right for firefighters and ER surgeons and professional fucking skateboarders. So, no, I don't feel bad for homing in on women who look like they're probably sweet. And to you, yes, maybe a little bit boring, because it doesn't seem to have occurred to you that maybe women like you think I'm boring.
Fuck that, I say.
What?
He says. I said fuck that. I repeat. I don't think you're boring, so that whole argument fails.
We're friends, he says. You wouldn't swipe right on me.
I would too, I say.
You would not, he argues.
And here's my chance to let it go, but I'm still too fired up, too annoyed to let him think he's right about this. I would.
Well, I would for you too,
he retorts, like somehow this is all some sort of argument.
Don't say something you don't mean, I warn. I wouldn't be wearing a blazer or sitting behind a desk smiling.
His lips press closed. His jaw muscles bounce as he swallows.
Okay, show me.
I open my own Tinder app and hand my phone over so he can see the picture. I'm smiling sleepily, dressed like an alien in a silver dress and face paint with aluminum antennae hot glued to my headband. Halloween, obviously. Or wait, was it Rachel's X-Files themed birthday party? Alex considers the photo seriously, then scrolls down to read my bio. After a minute, he hands my phone back to me and looks me dead in the eye.
I would.
My whole body tingles with pins and needles. Oh, I say, then manage a small, okay.
So, he says, are you done being mad at me?
I try to say something, but my tongue feels too heavy. My whole body feels heavy, especially where my hip is touching his. So I just nod. Thank God for his back spasm, I think. Otherwise, I'm not sure what would happen next. Alex studies me for a few seconds, then reaches for the forgotten laptop. His voice comes out thick.
What do you want to watch?
19. 6 summers ago.
Alex and I were both pretty strapped for cash when the resort in Vail, Colorado reached out to offer me a free stay. At that point, whether the trip would happen was up in the air. For one thing, when Guillermo broke up with me for a new hostess in his restaurant, a waifish, blue-eyed girl almost fresh off the plane from Nebraska, 6 weeks after I took the plunge and moved into his apartment, I had to scramble to find a new place to live, had to take an apartment on the high end of my price range, had to pay for a U-Haul for the second time in 2 months, had to buy new furniture to replace the stuff that had become redundant and thus been discarded. Guy already had nicer versions of my things. Sofa, mattress, Danish-look kitchen table. We'd kept my dresser because the leg on his was broken, and my bedside table because he only had the one. But other than that, pretty much everything we'd kept was his. The breakup came just after we'd gone to Linfield for Mom's birthday. For weeks beforehand, I'd debated whether to warn Guy what to expect. For example, the Beverly Hillbillies-style junkyard that was our front lawn, or Mom's museum to our childhood, as me and my brothers called the house itself. The baked goods my mother would pile up around the kitchen the whole time we were there, often with a frosting so thick and sweet it made non-rights cough as they ate, or the fact that our garage was riddled with things like once-used duct tape Dad was sure he could repurpose, or that we'd be expected to play a days-spanning board game we'd invented as kids based on Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, that my parents had recently adopted 3 senior cats, one of whom was incontinent to the point of having to wear a diaper, or that there was a decent chance he'd hear my parents having sex, because our house had thin walls, and, as previously stated, the Wrights are a loud clan. Or that there'd be a new talent show at the end of the weekend, where everyone was expected to perform some new feat they'd only started learning at the start of the visit. Last time I'd been home, Prince's talent had been having us call out the name of any movie and trying to connect it back to Keanu Reeves within 6 degrees. So I should have warned Guillermo what he was walking into, definitely, but doing so would have felt like treason. Like I was saying there was something wrong with them. And sure, they were loud and messy, but they were also amazing and kind and funny, and I hated myself for even considering being embarrassed by them. Guy would love them, I told myself. Guy loved me, and these were the people who'd made me. At the end of our first night there, we shut ourselves into my childhood bedroom, and he said,
I think I understand you better now than ever before.
His voice was as tender and warm as ever, but instead of love, it sounded like sympathy.
I get why you had to flee to New York, he said. It must have been so hard for you here.
My stomach sunk and my heart squeezed painfully, but I didn't correct him. Again, I just hated myself for being embarrassed. Because I had fled to New York, but I hadn't fled my family, and if I'd kept them separate from the rest of my life, it was only to protect them from judgment and myself from this familiar feeling of rejection. The rest of the trip was uncomfortable. Guy was kind to my family, he was always kind, but I saw every interaction they had through a lens of condescension and pity after that. I tried to forget the trip had happened. We were happy together in our real life in New York. So what if he didn't understand my family? He loved me. A few weeks later, we went to a dinner party at his friend's brownstone, someone he'd known from boarding school, a guy with a trust fund and a Damien Hirst painting hanging over the dining room table. I knew this, would never forget it, because when someone said the name, unrelated to the painting, I said, "Who?" and laughter followed. They weren't laughing at me. They genuinely thought I was making a joke. 4 days after that, Guillermo ended our relationship.
We're just too different, he said. We got swept up in our chemistry, but long term, we want different things.
I'm not saying he dumped me for not knowing who Damien Hirst was, but I'm not saying that either. When I moved out of the apartment, I stole one of his fancy cooking knives. I could have taken them all, but my mild form of revenge was imagining him looking everywhere for it, trying to figure out if he took it with him to a dinner party or if it fell into the gap between his enormous refrigerator and the kitchen island. Frankly, I wanted the knife to haunt him. Not in a "my ex is going to go all Glenn Close and Fatal Attraction" way, but in a "something about this missing knife seems to be conjuring a strong metaphor and I can't figure out what it's saying" way. I started feeling guilty after a week in my new apartment, once the sobbing wore off, and considered mailing the knife back, but thought that might send the wrong message. I imagined Guy showing up to the police department with the package and decided I'd just let him buy a new knife. I thought about selling the stolen one online and worried the anonymous buyer would turn out to be him, so I just kept it and resumed my sobbing until I was done 3-ish weeks later. The point is, breakups suck. Breakups between cohabitating partners in overpriced cities suck a little extra, and I wasn't sure I'd be able to afford a summer trip this year. And then there was the matter of Sarah Torval. Adorable, willowy yet athletic, clean-faced, brown eyeliner-wearing Sarah Torval, who Alex had been seriously dating for 9 months. After their first chance encounter when Alex was visiting friends in Chicago, their texting had quickly evolved into phone calls, and then another visit. After that, they'd gotten serious fast, and after 6 months long distance, she'd taken a teaching job and moved to Indiana to be with him while he finished his MFA. She's happy to stay there while he works toward his doctorate and will probably follow him wherever he lands afterward. Which would make me happy, if not for my increasing suspicion that she hates me. Whenever she posts pictures of herself holding Alex's brand new baby niece with captions like "family time" or "this little love bug," I like the post and comment, but she refuses to follow me back. I even unfollowed and refollowed her once in case she hadn't noticed me the first time.
I think she feels kind of weird about the trip,
Alex admits on one of our now fewer and farther between calls. I'm pretty sure he only calls me from the car when he's on his way to or from the gym. I want to tell him that calling me only when she's not around probably isn't helping. But the truth is, I don't want to talk to him while anyone else is around. So instead, this is what has become of our friendship. 15-minute calls every couple weeks, no texting, no messaging, hardly any emailing except the occasional one-liner with a picture of the tiny black cat he found in the dumpster behind his apartment complex. She looks like a kitten, but according to the vet, she's fully grown, just small. He sends me pictures of her sitting in shoes and hats and bowls, always writing "for scale," but really, I know he just thinks everything she does is adorable. And sure,
It's cute that cats like to sit in things, but it's quite possibly cuter that Alex can't stop himself from taking pictures of it. He hasn't named her yet. He's taking his time. He says it wouldn't feel right to name a grown thing without knowing it, so for now he calls her Cat, or Tiny Sweetie, or Little Friend. Sarah wants to call her Sadie, but Alex doesn't think that fits, so he's biding his time. The cat is the only thing we ever talk about these days. I'm surprised Alex would be so forthright as to tell me that Sarah feels weird about the summer trip. Of course she does, I tell him. I would too. I don't blame her at all. If my boyfriend had a friendship with a girl like Alex's and mine, I would wind up in the yellow wallpaper. There's no way in hell I could believe it was wholly platonic, especially having been in this friendship long enough to accept that 5 to 15-ish% of what if as part of the deal. So what do we do? He asks. I don't know, I say, trying not to sound miserable. Do you want to invite her? He's quiet for a minute.
I don't think that's a good idea.
Okay. And then, after the longest pause ever, I say, should we just cancel? Alex sighs. He must have me on speakerphone because I can hear his turn signal clicking.
I don't know, Poppy. I'm not sure.
Yeah, me neither. We stay on the phone, but neither of us says anything else for the rest of his drive.
I just got home, he says eventually. Let's talk about this again in a few weeks. Things could change by then.
What things, I want to ask, but don't, because once your best friend is someone else's boyfriend, the boundaries between what you can and can't say get a whole lot firmer. I spend the whole night after our phone call thinking, is he going to break up with her? Is she going to break up with him? Is he going to try to reason with her? Is he going to break up with me? When I get the offer of a free stay from the resort in Vail, I send him the first text I've sent in months. Hey, give me a call when you've got a sec. At 5:30 the next morning, my phone rings me awake. I peer through the dark at his name on the screen and fumble the call on to hear his turn signal tapping out a rhythm. He's on his way to the gym.
What's up? He asks.
I'm dead, I groan.
What else?
Colorado, I say. Vail. 20. This summer. I wake up next to Alex. He insisted that the bed in Nikolai's Airbnb was plenty big, that neither of us should risk another night on the fold-out chair, but we're right in the middle of the mattress by the time morning comes. I'm on my right side, facing him. He's on his left, facing me. There's half a foot between us, except that my left leg is sprawled over him, my thigh hooked up against his hip, his hand resting high up on it. The apartment is hellishly hot, and we're both drenched with sweat. I need to extricate myself before Alex wakes up, but the ludicrous part of my brain wants to stay here, replaying the look he gave me, the way his voice sounded last night when he sized up my dating profile and said, I would. Like a dare. Then again, he was on muscle relaxants at the time. Today, if he remembers that at all, he will almost definitely be regretful and embarrassed. Or maybe he'll remember sitting next to me for the length of an egregiously underwhelming documentary about the Kinks and feeling like a live wire, sparking every time our arms brushed.
You usually fall asleep during these,
he pointed out with a mild smile, jostling his leg against mine. But when he looked down at me, his hazel eyes seemed to be part of a different expression entirely, one with sharp edges and even some hunger. I shrugged and said something like, just not tired, and tried to focus on the movie. Time moved at an oily slog, every second beside him striking me with new intensity as if we'd just started touching again and again and again for almost 2 hours. It was early when the movie ended, so we started another documentary that was boring and mindless, just background noise to make it feel okay that we were riding this line. At least, I was pretty sure that was what we'd been doing. The way his hand is spread over my thigh now sends another prickly rush of want through me. A very nonsensical part of me wants to nestle closer until we're touching all over and wait to see what happens when he wakes up. All those memories from Croatia froth to the surface of my mind, sending desperate flashes out through my body. I pull my leg off him, and his hand tightens on me reflexively, loosening when I drag myself clear from under it. I roll away and sit up just as Alex is stirring awake, his eyes slitting open sleepily, hair wild with bedhead.
"Hey," he rasps. My own voice comes out thick.
"How'd you sleep?"
"Good, I think," he says. "You?"
"Good. How's your back?"
"Let me see."
Slowly, he pushes himself up, turning to slide his long legs over the side of the bed. He cautiously stands.
"A lot better."
He has an enormous erection and seems to notice at the same time I do. He folds his hands in front of himself and looks around the apartment, squinting.
"There's no way it was this hot when we fell asleep."
He's probably right, but I have no real recollection of how hot it was last night. I wasn't thinking clearly enough to process the heat. Today cannot go the way of yesterday. No more lounging around the apartment. No more sitting together on the bed. No more talking about Tinder. No more falling asleep together and half mounting him while unconscious. Tomorrow, wedding festivities will begin for David and Tom. Bachelor parties, rehearsal dinner, wedding. Today, Alex and I need to have enough uncomplicated, unconfusing fun that when we get home, he doesn't need another 2-year break from me.
"I'll call Nikolai about the AC again," I say. "But we should get moving. We've got a lot to do."
Alex runs his hand up his forehead and into his hair.
"Do I have time to shower?"
My heart gives a sharp pulse, and just like